Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to a companion episode to the Showmax original, Original Sin. Last month, Showmax released its incredible 90-minute documentary film, Original Sin. The documentary focuses on the murder of Andrea Fenter. I haven't covered the case on the podcast yet, but after watching Original Sin, I somehow think that this case will need far more than one episode. Original Sin is honestly one of the most incredible true crime documentaries I've watched in a long time. Not only does it focus on the victim and the terrible crime committed against her, it also delves down into many more issues related to the case and the individuals involved. Issues that, honestly, will blow your mind. I had the huge pleasure of chatting with Jana Marks, the editorial producer, and John Gutierrez, the director of Original Sin, to do a deeper dive into the making of the show and to ask some questions I still had after the credits rolled. Before I get into that conversation, though, for those listeners who are not familiar with Andrea Fenter's case, I'm going to give you a summarized breakdown for context. Andrea Fenter had been dating Gerard Jansen van Vieren for a while before she broke up with him. The man was incredibly abusive, both physically and emotionally, and Andrea no longer saw a future with him. She had also begun to fear for her life and took steps to try and protect and distance herself from Gerard. By 2011, she'd moved to a new apartment complex and started a new job. But Gerard was relentless and eventually tracked her down to her new place of employment. The extent of his abuse and the level of his obsession is well documented in Original Sin, but the crux of this case is that Andrea did not survive Gerard's abuse. On the 2nd of May 2011, Gerard brutally murdered Andrea at her apartment complex and then slit his own throat. While Andrea's wounds killed her on the scene, Gerard survived and was arrested. And although Andrea's murder is horrifying and vicious enough, it is also far too common. What happened after Gerard's arrest, though, was not. Despite the viciousness of Andrea's murder and CCTV evidence proving that Gerard had committed the murder, he was able to get bail. And in 2013, he disappeared. He was eventually tracked down in Brazil. That sounds very simple, but there's an entire story just about that part in the documentary. And he was arrested there. After some more legal kerfuffle in that country, again, not as simple as I make it sound, van Vieren was finally returned to South Africa in 2020 and stood trial for Andrea's murder. He was found guilty and handed down a life sentence. Even just that short summary gives you a clue about the strangeness and complexity of this case. But trust me, you've seen and heard nothing until you watch Original Sin. And if you already have, you know that to be true. If you haven't yet watched Original Sin, you might want to pause here and go do that. But really, you'll find value in listening to this and then going to Showmax and watching it then too. Either way, up to you. Now, into my discussion with John Gutierrez and that familiar name to all of us, Jana Marks.
I'm Jana Marks, and I'm the editorial producer for Original Sin.
Hi, I'm John Gutierrez, and I am the director of Original Sin.
I wondered how both Jana and John had come to know about Andrea's case. Jana, of course, being a South African and a journalist, would likely have a longer history with the case.
I was actually quite young when this happened back in 2011. So I think living in South Africa, you read about true crime cases, especially high profile ones like this one. But I think the case really grabbed my interest the moment Gerard ran. It was about 2 years after he killed Andrea. and he skipped bail and he fled. And then the story kind of died down. Everyone was looking for him, but no one really reported on the case because, well, obviously, no journalist really had a clue where Gerard was. And then suddenly, 2019-2020, we learned that there were new developments. And next thing we knew, Gerard arrived on Oliver Tambo, and yeah, he's then been extradited for trial. And soon after that, he stood trial for murdering Andrea and was convicted.
And John, of course, being an American, I would think would have come across this case in a different way.
So I didn't hear about this case when it first broke in 11. I think at that time I was living in London, and the news just didn't make it to me. But several years later in 2020, when I was living in South Africa, I did come across the case in 2020 and started to read about how he was returning to South Africa. And around the same time, I was approached by the production companies, Electric Shadow and Rogan Productions, and they were thinking about doing a film on the case. And so I didn't know what I was going to do because I had never made a true crime documentary before. So I kind of took it lightly and took it slowly and didn't read too much in the news about it. I first wanted to see what the producers and the researchers had found. And that's when I began my journey into learning about this case, learning about Gerhard and Andrea Venter, and really delving into the material for the first time.
I don't know about you, but I'm not too clued up on the different roles that people play in documentaries or films. I mean, you see these credits going past, and it's a lot of people. But what is the difference even between what a director does and what a producer does? Well, besides directing and producing, I guess. I asked Jana and John to clarify their roles in the making of the documentary.
Yeah, at the time I was producing for Carte Blanche, and one of the companies that was involved in the co-production is Combined Artists, the producers of Carte Blanche. And they needed someone from their side to help navigate content. They did a lot of research, but then they needed some editorial production. So they asked me to help in that capacity. And although it's not really something, you know, it's like a side role, I also worked as, let's say, field producer, going out scouting locations and stuff like that. But as editorial producer, it just means I was largely responsible to line up the people we wanted to interview and contribute a key if you want to, just to make sure they feel safe and feel valued, to prep them to do the pre-interviews so John knows exactly what content there is to work with. So John, I think we talked for like, I don't know how many months straight, probably every single day. At one point, John told me, I'm the first message he gets when he wakes up and I'm the last one before he signs off at night, which will be my morning. We just talked about the story, and obviously the research would give you some sort of idea or framework, but depending on the pre-interviews, we managed to create the story. So I think, John, the best way to describe this probably is you had the story, you did enough research for that, and then I helped you to make that vision, to realize that vision if you want to, just to advise on content, what can work, what can't work, and just make it happen.
Yes, that's exactly what it was like. Jan and I had a lot of conversations. You know, I, as the director of the film, started once all the initial research was done. The Combined Artists worked with Electric Shadow and Rogan Productions to do the research. And I'm not sure how much time that took, but they had a team of great journalists there and researchers who, I think this was before Jana was on the project, but yeah. They basically go out and do and just see if there's a story there, right? Like, of course there's a story there, but see if it's anything more than what we've seen already covered in the general news and general news stories. Like, what else might be there that has yet been told? Because of course we want to bring a fresh angle to it and something different. So once it came to me, you know, because I'm not from the true crime world, and I wasn't really that excited about making a true crime documentary, because most of the time you see them and it kind of sometimes feels a little sensational, and the victims are kind of, you know, just not really present in the narratives, but because it was Rogan Productions and because Sarah, the producer, was behind it, they wanted to do something different. They did want to center the victim story. And so my interest started there. And as I dug into the research, you know, my job primarily is to basically shine a light on what I think the story is. And of course, you know, we have heard the plot at this point, but the plot isn't this real story. You know, what is this heart and soul, this thing? And the obvious thing was Gerhard, the killer's mother, Tia. So Tia was something that, you know, she was a mystery, right? Who is this woman who seemingly abandoned her children when they were very young and then tries to have relationships with them? And then when this happens, right, she supports her son and she's, you know, aiding and abetting, and then she turns on him. So that is a complicated journey. That is a story of motherhood that I'm interested in, right? And when it comes to Gerhard, you know, what shapes him? You know, what made him who he was? And how much was his family and environment involved in that? And those are things that I could really relate to. And I feel like as a filmmaker and director, you need to find things that personally you can relate to and tell a personal story. And as soon as we got going, as soon as production became a reality, it was, we were so lucky to bring on Yana. We had different people in that role and it just wasn't right. We hadn't even started anything, but when Yana came on, we're like, this is the perfect person. And she was indispensable because she knew the story so well and she knew the area and the characters so well. So there's no way I could have her experience, right? I'm an outsider for all intents and purposes. And so we would have these long conversations, and it was day after day conversations, me asking her again about these people, about their choices, about why they may have done that. What, you know, what was it like for her growing up a certain way? What was her experience like? And all these things inform the documentary. And it's really through these conversations that the film gets made. And of course, there are other ones with the editor, with the producer. But Yana and I really had to unpack a lot all the time. And we would second guess ourselves and, you know, reinterrogate the characters because, of course, we wanted to make the best film and represent the victim and in a way bring her to life in the best way possible.
And John touches on something there I had wondered about. Of all the many crime cases that have played out in our country, why this particular murder case for a documentary?
I think it naturally has all those twists and turns that you kind of like to experience in a thriller, right? Or a mystery. And from the producer's perspective, you know, I wasn't a producer on this, but I would think that and the fact that it's a global story, right? It takes place through several countries. I feel like that's appealing to an audience and appealing to a producer because you suddenly think, okay, this is something that isn't just, you know, in a small town, just in South Africa. This is something that crosses borders. This is something where we can, you know, see audiences attaching. But even more than that, you know, it is a story about femicide. It is a story about gender-based violence. And these are, you know, huge things that a lot of societies are wrestling with, especially South Africa, Brazil, you know, I mean, across the world, really. So I feel like those three things made it possible for a film like this to be made because it means a big audience would be interested.
I think most South Africans know Yana Marks as a respected journalist and author, but she's been shifting toward more of a film-based career for a while now. Love that for her, by the way. And I asked her to share a bit of that journey and what it's been like for her.
Yeah, I think first and foremost, I'm a journalist and true crime just happens to be the genre that I enjoy working in. It actually comes from a background of court reporting. I used to cover a lot of court cases, sit in court day after day, different cases, different courts. And I think it's an inherent thing of a journalist wanting to see justice or perhaps contributing to justice is reporting on it, make the story known, making sure that someone doesn't only remain a statistic, but, you know, becomes the character or the person that people can relate to. And, well, I'm a creative, so I think I love journalism. I still love it. I'm writing stories as we speak, different stories for different publications. But something in me changed when Devil's Door happened. I realized you can take journalism to TV. And I think for me as a creative, it's just so, it's fascinating. And it's so fascinating to see that you can tell a story in a way that really speaks to every single sense of a person. And that's the best way I accept or receive stories. So I wanted to enter that world. And then I started producing for Carte Blanche. And because I was still writing books and still writing news stories, this just made so much sense. This was the first editorial production role that I had. All the other times, I was just a journalist consultant. So this time it was a bit more responsibility and I was a bit more involved with the film, which was really, really a great journey for me. But yeah, that's where I see myself now. Journalism, but on TV.
John is based in Los Angeles. He's American, as I'm sure his accent clued you into. And I always wonder about creators from other countries and their experience with creating within our borders.
So I've been in a relationship with South Africa for the last 20 years now, I think, since I've been with my partner, who is from Cape Town and South African. So I've frequently gone down there, you know, from New York or London, spent summers and time and have shot little documentary films. And then when we moved down there and were living there for a while, I made a feature film called Sons of the Sea, and that did quite well. And then commercial projects as well. But I love filming in South Africa. I love working with the people there. They have, the filmmakers have such a kind of independent spirit. You know, in a way, when I was living in the UK, they didn't have, you know, it was like, let's wait in line. We must queue until we get, you know, the money to do something. And in South Africa, you can just do it. And it reminds me of that American independent filmmaking style. You know, you have a camera, you have a team, you have a story, and you just go and find it and see what it becomes. And that's how I made my first feature film there. And that freedom of filmmaking is why I love shooting in South Africa, because if you need something, you can get it. You know, if you want to shoot somewhere, most likely you'll be able to negotiate that space to film in. And that's very freeing as a filmmaker, you know, especially in a film like this, where you hear a story told to you in an interview, and all of a sudden you have a lot of ideas and you can quickly pivot what you want to film and how you want to film that B-roll or a reenactment or something like this. And you're able to do that quite easily in South Africa. So that's what makes it enjoyable for me as a director.
I think that really encapsulates South Africa and its people really well, right? We are incredibly resilient people. And we've always got 12 more plans in our pockets if plan A doesn't work out.
People don't say, like, people never say no. It's like, yeah, give me a minute, you know, or like, I'll be right back. And I'm sure you, I will say that it's very annoying sometimes, because it's like, oh, I just got this museum. And it's like, no, that we don't want to do that anymore, you know. But
all I would tell John, someone said no, it's like, no, why am I hearing no? Why am I hearing no?
But there's an energy there, you know, and when you shoot something in, you know, that's a studio thing or something in LA that's big, there are so many rules and regulations, you know, it's harder to let life into the room. And that's what you want. You know, you want to let as much life into the room and not control everything. You know, you can't control it. And documentary filmmaking is life. So my approach is to, of course, do all the preparation as much as possible, but then you have to go through a process of letting go. And if things don't come together that day the way they're supposed to, they did actually come together the way they were supposed to. You know, that's how it was supposed to be. I remember one day with Tia, we were doing a follow-up interview, and I wanted to see her, you know, at this point in her house. You know, she had cats. I think she was living with someone. And I just imagine these, images and these portraits of her, and then her giving this, hour-long updated interview. But we spent the whole day trying to find a location to even just film in, because she didn't want to film in her house. And we were hanging out with her and driving around, and we ended up doing like a 5-minute interview that never made it into the film in a park. But what I really wanted from Tia was closure, really, on a personal level, because we had gone so deep, several months or a year before. And I wanted her to give the film its blessing. And I think in that moment, that's what she did, and we didn't need the interview. We didn't need, more B-roll of her. What the film needed was that. It needed her blessing. I think for any artist, creative, person who's passionate about telling a story or working on a piece of art, it's just not going to be good unless you're personally attached to it. You have to give a part of your soul to it. It has to reflect who you are, have your point of view, and a part of you has to be in it. That's kind of the driving force that gets you up in the morning to make the thing. And I think that's what really separates, decent stuff from much better stuff, is really doing the stuff that is a part of you, the stuff that's in you that scares you, maybe that frightens you, and challenging that, right? I feel like that's what a lot of us did on this project. And it's really what separates, maybe, I don't want to speak for Johanna, but maybe what straight journalism is, when you maybe write a story in a paper, and then when you take that journalism and then create a film. Because yes, we're using journalism to help tell the story, but it's not journalism. There's so many layers that are happening. There's so many creative choices between the edits that other things are being revealed, personal things. There's an emotional story there, an emotional connection to the audience. And that's what we're doing. We're making art, so it is emotional.
I want to add to that, just this being journalism or not. I think people often think that journalists are not allowed to have emotions. If you have emotions, you can't report objectively. I don't think that's true at all. I think the difference between a decent and a great journalist is someone who can experience feelings and put them in the shoes of the other person and still stick to the facts, but manages to tell that story. So, John, I do think journalism, I just think it's a much deeper level than journalism. And I actually think that journalism, short form or the news reports, it should usually be 350 to 400 words. I mean, because of space, word restraints in papers or whatever, you can't really delve into those details. But I think there are different sides to journalism. And the longer one, the one that can actually tell the entire story, is the one that I prefer.
I thought perhaps it's maybe this that had drawn Jana to this medium, the freedom of depth to explore.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I've learned, especially investigative journalism, we always have people who will push back. Let's say you cover a corruption story or whatever. Mm-hmm. People will push back on facts and tell you they're innocent until proven guilty and tell you to wait until the court case has concluded and all that. But you can never take away from what people are feeling. And I think this is exactly what you're saying. In Original Sin, we had space, number one, which is a rare thing if you're a journalist, mm-hmm. space in terms of time. And we could tell the story behind the story. We could tell how whatever happened made people feel. And I think that's almost like a golden thread throughout true crime. And that's why I also love true crime. Yes, it's a right and a wrong. And it's one thing to only cover a court case and to write about a verdict. But to explain the why and to explain the effect, I just think every story becomes so much bigger.
One of the major themes in Original Sin is gender-based and intimate partner violence. And South Africa is absolutely no stranger to the scourge of both. In dissecting these cases, we often find points at which the system or something else sends a victim down a path to tragedy. I asked Jana whether she'd found such a point in her delving into Andrea's case. Was there anything she could point to and say, there, that's where it all went wrong? And maybe that's where it's going wrong for many victims.
I think we were trying to explain a world, and I'm not saying that's the only world where GBV originates, but a context and an upbringing that kind of contributes or nurtures someone, or can I say push someone into a direction. People are the way they are because of nature and nurture. And we were delving into the nurture side of this, looking into Gerard's family, his background, people he surrounded himself with. And it was very interesting to get a sense of exactly what he grew up in by talking to many people living in that community. So I think it was very interesting for me to see that there are people thinking in a certain way, which actually makes sense for this crime to happen in that particular context. And I think that is a problem we have. We are not able to fight against mindsets, very set mindsets in South Africa, driven by a certain wing of religion, a certain way of thinking. I think it's a very deep-rooted thing. GBV is not only something that we do. It's a really, really deep thing. It goes back into our history, and it's frightening to hear people in 2024 talk in a certain way that still makes sense in a world of gender-based violence. It's almost an obvious effect or consequence if you hear how they are talking about women.
I think Yana said it quite nicely. I don't know if I can't speak specifically, no. You know, about South Africa or why things happen, but I do know there are parallels, you know, with, you know, these patriarchy communities and societies with South Africa and the US. I mean, even the one I grew up in, which is a very Mexican American community, and, you know, there is patriarchy, right? Mm-hmm. And these things do happen. And it's like Yana was saying, it's people not saying anything, you know, it's people accepting it like it's normal. And for me, that's a big issue. And especially when it comes to men, you know, who feel it's not right, they have to tell other men that it's not right, you know, and you have to bring up those young boys with that mindset. So it's not just you can pass a law and it prevents it. It's generational, right? So it'll take work from a lot of different sides to really see change, because it's way too prevalent. And it's about raising your sons and speaking to each other about why you're doing this and why it's not right. And so when I look at it, I feel like that's the work that men need to do before we can create some change.
And additionally, women should stop talking, reinforcing it, because it's not only men at fault here. There are so many women, and women we spoke to during the production of the story, who actually just reinforced what the men were doing and thinking. So they are actually, it's double the impact here.
There are many elements of Andrea Fencer's murder and the ensuing chaos that I've often thought may be uniquely South African, or at the very least, unique to countries with socioeconomic and justice issues like South Africa's. John grew up in California, and I asked him whether, while dealing with this case in the documentary, there was ever a time where he thought this case could have just been picked up and transplanted right into the United States, or if there were elements that he felt would just never happen there.
I think this kind of thing always happens in America, as far as the gender-based violence and then the killing. The way the case unfolded these days, of course, you always hear stuff like wild stuff happens in America, right? You know, with the criminal justice system. But him getting out on bail, I don't see that happening. And I think, of course, that was one of the biggest mistakes with this case, right? That he was allowed bail. So I kind of feel, I mean, it could happen, but it would have been much more rare. And we're not sure what him and his father were up to, or what kind of corruption or level of corruption was involved. Of course, there's corruption at all levels in the States. But for someone without means, it would have been very difficult to get bail. And so perhaps that could have been prevented at that level. But again, you know, it's a huge country. There are a ton of small towns and cities and jurisdictions. So something similar probably has happened.
Something that struck me when I watched Original Sin was that at its heart, it was not the tale of Gerard and Andrea. It was the tale of two women, Andrea and Tia, Gerard's mother. As so often happens in these cases, many wondered why Andrea hadn't left sooner, hadn't left better, hadn't made a cleaner break. Of course, these questions are unfair, and really, as we find, Andrea did try to get away from Gerard. But the irony, for me at least, comes in when Tia enters the frame. Because, well, she did leave her abuser. As we discover in Original Sin, and spoiler alert if you haven't watched it, Tia left her husband, Gerard's father, when her children were young, because her life was in danger. She says that she was forced to leave her children behind, and it seems that much of what Gerard ended up being exposed to in his childhood revolves around this situation. And as a result, Tia finds herself all these years later answering for her son's deeds, partially carrying the blame of his crimes because she did leave. So it struck me that as women, and yes, this may also apply to male victims of abuse, of course, but I think it's particularly applicable to female victims. Are we damned if we do, and damned if we don't?
Yeah, I think this is exactly the message we tried to get across, John. Please jump in. But I think John managed to brilliantly tell exactly that, almost a juxtaposition. Where Tia relates, or where the mom of the killer relates with the victim, it's quite unprecedented. I haven't seen a doc from that point of view, actually. And that inner conflict, and you see how it unfolds as the film progresses. You see how Tia experiences guilt, where she has a little like flicker of joy remembering the son that she had, or the little boy with the soft-spoken boy loved nature. And then that realization where, or that her acting, aiding and abetting her son, and then realized this is not right. And her having lost a child herself, realizing that the only way the Fenters will ever get closure is for this case to go into a direction. And she's literally the only one that can help with that. So I think we learn a lot about Andrea by listening to Tia, and we learn a lot about Tia by listening to Andrea's story told by people close to her.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, Yana, what you just said now. And, you know, when we were editing the film, and as soon as we saw this, like, wow, you know, it is a story of two victims who are kind of a reflection of each other. And we dove deeper and deeper into that and really made that the story behind the story. And it's all there already, right? You know, when Tia says, I think very early on, that he should have killed me, and she said it in interviews before, she's already projecting herself onto Andrea in that moment. But in the course of the interview, and you see it in the film, there is a huge moment in the film where it's a turning point, where she decides that, you know, justice needs to have its day, and she's going to do what she can to help the authorities find her son. She comes to that realization in the interview, in that moment where they're twinned, you know, they're in this together. She's not only doing it for Andrea, she's doing it for herself. And going back to the whole thing of how victims are stuck in this space, and people on the outside always say, you know, why can't you just leave them? It's hard to imagine, because I feel like we've all been on the outside saying, well, look, clearly, you know, there's violence, you have to leave them. And it's complicated because sometimes those people are in love with their abuser, right? And sometimes they have tried to leave them, and In Andrea's case, she did, and she tried to turn to the law, but there wasn't enough. And we can't discount how much the community they're in kind of supports that toxic relationship or positively reinforces it, you know, because it's normal. And in Dia's case, it was very normal. I don't think a lot of this made it into the film, but when I asked her that, it was, she would go, because she was a young mother in these small towns, you go to the local police station, and those guys are friends with your husband. You know, they're having drinks on the weekend. They go to the same church. It's happening everywhere, right? So it can drive one mad because there is no help. There's nowhere you can go when that is the norm, but escape. And we can look at the end and say, well, she abandoned her kids, and she did abandon her children. And that's something she doesn't run away from. And I think it's something we don't run away from in the storytelling. And that's what makes her a fascinating, complicated character, right? Because a part of you hates her, doesn't like her that she did this, you know, because is that the thing, right? Is that the thing that made Gerhard who he was? Was that the thing? And I felt myself going back there all the time, but it's a very simplistic way to look at it, right? Because of course, it's not just that one thing. It's many things, and he has free will and he's a choice. And I can't speak with Thea, but we did have long, intimate conversations. And she wanted to make amends with Andrea and her family, you know, as well as her own past. And for Thea, I think this all came at a great cost, right? She's incredibly brave for doing this and sharing her story. And she really exposes herself and how she's failed as a mother. And that must be so difficult to deal with for a parent, for a mother to share that. But often, you know, it often made me think of the classic, you know, book, Crime and Punishment. And she, in her own way, has invented her own punishment for leaving her children, her own punishment for aiding and abetting her children. But she's also found healing in that process and exposing this truth.
There are so many layers of societal issues that come to the fore in this documentary. Because what Tia did, really, at the heart of it, is she chose herself. She did also seem to feel at the time that what she was doing was best for her children. But when faced with the decision between dying at the hands of her abuser and leaving and surviving, she chose to save her life. And if she had not been a mother, she would have been applauded for that. But I feel like the minute that label of mother was bestowed upon her, any instance in which she chose herself from then onward would be demonized by society.
And I think there are people who will probably watch this film and judge her immediately on that, you know? And kind of not interrogate that identity and what it means for T and what it means for them. But she was trapped. Of course she needed to escape to save herself, because what can you do for your children if you're trapped and you can't be a mother, right? So I imagine she was trying to save herself so she could be a mother, you know, so she could help them. And she did come back into their lives and try her best to be the mom she could be.
Because the other option was that she would end up dead, like Andrea. And I often think about this idea we have of victims of crime and how we think differently about deceased victims and surviving victims. We often allow far less grace for surviving victims because their narratives continue on. Maybe with deceased victims, society, the true crime viewing or listening community, whoever, can almost control the narrative, because now that victim has paid the ultimate price. And it sounds horrific, but I often compare public reaction to cases, and I think that certain victims would have been viewed in a far better light if they had lost their lives. It's sad, but I feel like it's true in a lot of instances. and certainly in Tia's case. Just the fact that this documentary has made me think this deeply about how we as a true crime consuming audience see victims is pretty incredible for Original Sin. On Hedart's side of the story, there are additional layers besides his mom. There are shocking allegations about things that happened in his family and what his father may or may not have done. I wondered how these things came to light and whether Tia shared them with the production team.
So Tia mentioned, I think, almost everything, but it was obviously up to us to corroborate that as best as we could. And sometimes you can't, let's say, prove an allegation, but we needed, let's say, enough other evidence to make it make sense. Even if it's just a suggestion, not to put as a fact. So Tia did mention Gavin. Tia mentioned the explosives, but it was quite interesting to us when we actually realized those dockets exist. Some of the things that she's alluding to are actually quite plausible, scaringly so.
The medium of film, although more in-depth than written journalism, is still limited by time. You have 90 minutes or whatever it may be to say what you want to say. I'm lucky that way. I can waffle on as long as I want to. And really, that's why these companion podcasts exist, to add to and delve deeper into the themes presented. And often in any art form, you have to kill your darlings, so to speak. Not sure if that's a great metaphor to use in true crime. But I did want to know from John and Jana whether there was anything that they would have liked to be included in the documentary that didn't make it to the final cut.
We are limited by time when we're working in feature documentary form and structure because, you know, feature documentaries, usually 80 to 90 minutes is the average length. And so you got to pick and choose the stories you want to tell. At one point, we were playing with a series, you know, and I think it could have definitely been a documentary series. But, you know, there's certain kind of financial implications of that. And so that didn't work. But, you know, there are a lot more stories about Gerard and his father, right, that support Tia's claim of how his father, almost like he was grooming him to become a murderer. And those stories, to get to the heart of them, the kind of actions and things he did to other women before Andrea, right? That takes time to investigate those stories. So there were other stories about Gerard and his father before what happened with Andrea happened. And I think those stories, for me, they kind of built up and you can really see the making of a murderer, right? The making of a killer by the actions they took toward other women. But if you don't have the time, you don't have the resources to really dive into the stories and speak to the people, or if those people aren't willing to share those stories, then you can't put them as a part of the film. You know, as much as I wanted to, there just wasn't enough there. You know, and then there is this whole time that Gerard is in, he's in Brazil, right? And what's happening there in the prison? How is he earning money? How is he kind of getting a judge to release him, even though there's this red notice on his file, right? For him to be extradited back to South Africa. But there was a lot of questions that were raised, and we heard stories about what he may or may not have been involved in. But again, it would take a huge amount of resources to find out the truth behind those stories. And if you can't find people that are willing to share their story with you, or you don't have the resources to find that truth, then it just can't make it into the film. But there's a lot more than what we have in the film.
I definitely think one thing that I would have wanted to explore deeper, and this was quite an interesting thing for me, the interaction between Gerard and Andrea when they were amongst friends. But we really struggled to find friends willing to speak because people were just so scared of Gerard. I think I've approached perhaps 10 of Andrea's friends, even the people they met at a wedding of two friends. Even those people, they were just scared to speak. They are so afraid of Gerard. So I think it would have been interesting to know how they were in a group of friends, how they would interact. We got that from one of the friends who didn't make it into the film for other reasons. But yeah, I would have wanted to explore the relationship more. It was a very difficult topic, although that was the whole crux of the story.
So what I'm hearing Jana and John saying is that this case actually needs to be a multi-part investigative podcast series. If anyone wants to fund that, hashtag mail me. Original Sin is not just being released to South African viewers. The documentary is going international. And I wondered, besides the Brazilian connection, why the team thinks the story would be as relevant in other countries.
I think the global theme of GBV, it's not just a South African issue. It's especially a South African issue. But it's a global issue. So the UN has stats saying more than 5 women and girls are killed every hour across the world by their partners or families. So intimate partner violence, which is a global theme, no matter which country watches Original Sin. So I think that is part of the reason why international companies chose the story, because it speaks to every audience.
Yeah, just to add to that, you see it in the interviews we do with the federal police in Brazil and how they connect emotionally to the story. I think one of the investigators brings up his cousin who was brutally murdered, you know, who was a school teacher. But I think the fact that these stories and gender-based violence is an issue that several countries wrestle with, it women and men will know people who are going through similar things. And for me, that's been a huge thing in that people come forward and say that it's touched them in that way, you know, and I think it'll do the same for audiences outside of South Africa, is that they will relate to it. They will see themselves or someone they know reflected in the story, and it'll make them feel something. And hopefully that will make them do something.
Feel something and do something. Original Sin made me feel a lot of different things. Many of those things I'm still sorting through in my mind. It's not often that I get this emotionally attached to a piece of film, but I really do think it's a documentary every South African, and really as many other people as possible across the world, need to see. I'm heartened to see this type of true crime content coming out of South Africa. We really are making huge strides in what I see as the ultimate goal for the genre. To break into it in an ethical way that means something to the victims. That isn't just gore and sensation. That, as John says, makes you feel something and makes you do something. A huge thank you to John Gutierrez and Jana Marks for engaging with me in this episode. And if you haven't yet watched Original Sin, it's on the Showmax platform right now. Go watch it, go share it, and get Original Sin in front of the people who need to see it. Because you never know who it could help.